Welcome to Medically Speaking, Auburn's own medical radio show with host Dr. Mark Vaughn of the Auburn Medical Group and Larry Finney.
Welcome to Medically Speaking Radio with your host, Dr. Mark Vaughn, and...
And I'm Larry Finney. Still.
Still. Okay.
After all these years, yeah.
And I guess we need to be honest and say we actually aren't in the studio right now.
Yeah, and that which reminds me, we have a listener email, Robert from Loomis, who writes, when are you guys going to be back live? Well, that's a darn good question. Our lives have been pretty busy. Once again, you're listening to us pre-recorded, but I believe in a week. Are we going to be live in a week?
Actually, I think it's...
a couple of weeks?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, until then, Robert, you're just going to have to hold on. You know, but hey.
But it's for a good reason. Good stuff's happening.
Right. It's better than having us gone altogether, I hope.
Yeah. We are very anxious to get back in the studio and do some live questions.
We miss Trevor.
Absolutely. I do have an announcement we need to let people know about before we get into today's show. There is a free educational lecture. It is titled Osteoporosis Fair. No, that's not the title. That's what it is. It's an Osteoporosis Fair and lecture. And the title is Prevention and Treatment Options of Osteoporotic Fractures. And it's going to have Dr. Robert Henriksen giving a talk actually on osteoporosis prevention and management and both medical and surgical treatments available. It starts at 5 o'clock. The actual talk with Dr. Henriksen doesn't start until 6 o'clock.
Don't we get some other unusual emails?
There was also something else that came through that wanted to be announced, and I'm not going to name the product, but they said it's Melanoma Awareness Month, and they want us to show this product that they showed on a medical TV show that allows people to track skin lesions to make sure they're not melanoma. And it includes transparency sheets and a permanent marker.
So basically what you're supposed to do is lay the transparency over the suspected spot and mark it with a permanent marker, which could be probably done with, you know, you can measure the darn thing with a ruler and write down the measurement.
Or take digital pictures of it with a ruler. Yeah, and do that on a monthly basis. So what we want to do is right now start our disclaimer and our commercial break so that we can come back talking to Dr. Bradshaw about cancer treatment.
The content of this website and the Medically Speaking radio show are meant for entertainment and for general information purposes.
No doctor-patient relationship is attempted or implied through the show or the website.
Any medical advice, home remedies, and all other medical information on this website or radio show should not be treated as a substitute for the medical advice of your own doctor.
Do not attempt any treatment mentioned on the website or the show without consulting your doctor.
Always consult your own doctor if you are in any way concerned about your health.
If you need a doctor and live near Placer County, call Jen at 530-886-8630.
If you have a medical emergency, call 911.
Medically Speaking Radio, Dr. Mark Vaughn, Auburn Medical Group, K-High Radio, and or our sponsors are not responsible for any diagnosis or treatment made by anyone based on any of the content of this website or the Medically Speaking Radio show.
In addition, the views and opinions expressed on the show or on linked websites are not necessarily those of Dr. Mark Vaughn,
K-High Radio, the Auburn Medical Group Incorporated, or any of the show sponsors.
Since 1966, Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital has been providing award-winning care to members of the community, to people just like you. The tradition of excellence continues today with our comprehensive family birth center, cancer services, 24-hour emergency care, and a whole range of outpatient services with convenient hours and locations to serve you.
In addition, we've been recognized for excellence in managing heart attacks, heart failure, pneumonia, and surgical care. We are one of a select few hospitals in the state to earn recognition from VHA's West Coast region for sustained outstanding clinical performance.
To learn more about Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, visit us on the web at sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio. That's sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio.
Sutter Health, with you for life.
Larry, have you ever been to Auburn Drug Company?
Yeah, that's the one with the marble soda fountain at 815 Lincoln Way.
Yeah, right there in front they have the marble fountain, and in back is an independently owned pharmacy right here in Auburn.
And that thing has been around for a long time.
Since the 1800s. They are so great because they actually fill your prescriptions when you ask them to, unlike the chain drug stores that make you wait.
You know, and waiting there wouldn't be a big crime because, heck, you could always go to the soda fountain. That's Auburn Drug Company at 815 Lincoln Way in downtown Auburn. Give them a call at 885-6524.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome to Medically Speaking Radio. We're back from the break, and as promised, we do have our guest, Dr. Barton Bradshaw of Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. Dr. Bradshaw, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, what we wanted to do was talk to you as a general surgeon. We have had other general surgeons on the show, but we've never really in detail told our audience what general surgery entails, along with telling us that. Could you tell us a bit of your background as far as medical school residency fellowship?
Yes, sir. I went to college in Boston at Harvard College. I then went to medical school at Washington University in St. Louis for 4 years. I did my surgery training at the Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle, Washington, and I came to Auburn fresh out of residency. I joined two physicians, surgeons here that turned out they both had also trained in Seattle, and they were looking for a partner, and we knew the same people, and I had family in Bay Area, so it was a nice fit, and that's how I ended up in Auburn.
Who were the partners at that time?
Dr. Monahan and Dr. Brooks, both of whom have moved on to other places in their careers now. So
that makes you the senior.
I'm the senior partner in Auburn.
Yeah, okay. And general surgery, I'm thinking particularly of a patient I actually had today who was asked me, what is a general surgeon?
Sometimes we get the mistaken notion that we're generalists and we're not really qualified at anything. We're jack of all trades, but actually don't know anything really well. It turns out it's probably a little bit of a bad name. As a general surgeon, we go to residency training for 5 years. Some residency programs have included some periods of mandatory research in along with that. So some places at the big academic centers are as long as 8 years for general surgery residency. But there's 5 clinical years that are required. And when they say general surgeon, essentially we take care of problems that aren't divided into other surgery specialties. So, for instance, neurosurgeons will do brain surgery and back surgery. Ear, nose, and throat surgeons will do head and neck problems, tonsillectomies, that kind of things. Orthopedic surgeons will do broken bones and backs and knees and knee replacements.
And we know what proctologists do.
General surgeons, we take care of problems within the abdomen and the chest. So I tell this to people jokingly. I'll put my kids through college taking out gallbladders and fixing hernias. Those are the bread and butter of the general surgeon. We also treat breast cancer. We treat colon cancer. We treat all cancers within the abdomen. We do burns, although most burns now, severe burns, are taken care of at burn centers. But those surgeons are general surgeons that sometimes do additional training in burn surgery after that. Trauma surgeons are essentially general surgeons that have done sometimes a year of extra trauma specialty training. So it's mostly bread and butter surgery that's not divided into taken up by other kinds of surgeons.
And during that 5 years of general surgery residency, you were rotating through all of those different departments you just mentioned.
Exactly. We do
all of it.
The first year is as an intern is fairly general, but most of it is centered in surgical specialties. We do 6 months of trauma training during our 5 years. We do 3 months of pediatric surgical training at the Children's Hospital. We do 3 months of heart surgery. Now, to be a heart surgeon, most of those surgeons have done 5 years of general surgery training, and then they do 3 additional years of heart and lung surgery after that. But during our residency as general surgeons, we also learn to do the basics of heart surgery and lung surgery.
I'm glad that we're talking about training. We don't talk about it a whole lot on other shows. And of course, it comes out with general surgery because that's one of the longest general residencies that
you cannot do that specialty for anything shorter than 5 years of training after medical school.
That's correct.
I have heard it estimated, at least when you trained and when I was training, that during that 5 years of general surgery residency, the number of hours you put in would equal a regular job's half of the time toward retirement. Have you heard that statistic thrown around?
I haven't heard that exactly, but it doesn't surprise me at all. When I was in training, and this was, again, I've been out for almost 13 years now. 120-hour weeks were not uncommon.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, though, that's changed recently in that there's been federal laws that have been passed limiting the amount of hours that residents can spend in the hospital. And it's been considered to be somewhat of a public health issue. Everybody knows that people don't function as well when they're tired, and these residency programs were designed partly to teach you, but also to immerse you in the surgical fields. And so there was a glib saying when I was in residency that the only bad thing about being every other night in the hospital is that you missed half the good cases.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so it really was stressful. The people that were training you, the older generation, it was worse for them when they were in training. I mean, most of them, they call them residents because they lived in the hospital, and they sometimes never left. There's been a gradual change in trying to get away from having people just be dead tired all the time, spending every waking hour in the hospital and, you know, staying up all night and having to work the whole next day. So the government has limited their work hours to 80 hours a week now is the official sort of mandated 80-hour work week. There's rules that prevent people from, when they're up all night, you're up 24 hours, you have to be off the next day. You can't do another shift the next day. And those have been met with, it's interesting in the surgical literature now, the old guard sort of writes about it, and there's some complaining. They feel like the new generation of surgeons, I don't exactly call them lazy, but there's a sense, oh, they didn't work as hard as we did. They don't know how to sacrifice like we did. Lifestyle's more important to them than it was to us.
Not as many of them died driving home.
Yeah, exactly. How are they going to get up in the middle of the night and take care of patients because they haven't learned to sacrifice like I did?
Well, limiting the work hours and mandating rest periods, and the government mandates that for truck drivers, for kind
of
bus
course,
drivers.
Of course, and for pilots, and for...
You know, and I think I would like the guy with the scalpel hovering over my abdomen to be well-rested, you know? I mean, just as well-rested as that truck driver riding my tail down the highway.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. One of the things, though, that is very clear is that there's an enormous amount of knowledge and skill to be learned during those 5 years of residency training. And although you want somebody that's rested when they're taking care of you, you also want somebody that has gone through training and knows how to do the operation they're about to do on you. And so I see that as a legitimate concern about limiting hours, is that if you're also limiting the experiences that people have and the kind of training that they're getting, that's a competing factor that you need to take account of. And there's been some talk about making residencies longer. If you're going to limit hours, then you got to make them longer. But people are already sacrificing, and you know, you're talking about people that have been in school from the time they were in kindergarten, and they're 33 or 34 years old, and they're still in training, and they're making not very much money. That's a downside to making residency programs longer as well, is that they're long enough already. So that's situations in flux now in the country, and there's people advocating on both sides, and you know, I think it's going to turn out to be fine eventually when things settle out, but there's some change.
So, well, now that you're well rested, you know, after you've had 13 years of rest, right, since graduation, what is describe for us your practice here in Auburn? What types of cases come to you typically for surgery? I mean, there's a whole gamut, but you know, by what's the most common, followed by the second most common?
The most common operation I do is a hernia operation, and hernias are about 8 times more common in men than they are in women. So, classically, it's a middle-aged man that notices a bulge in his groin, and it's sometimes associated with pain, and he'll go to his primary care doctor, and they'll refer them to me, and we'll talk about doing an operation to fix it. It's not something you can take a pill to fix. You got to do an operation to fix it. I see a lot of patients with gallbladder disease. In the United States, gallbladder disease is very, very common. Estimated 10 to 15% of the population have gallstones. Now, I don't always take those out. I usually take them out when they become symptomatic. So when people get pain after eating McDonald's French fries, they come to see me, and I'll take their gallbladder out. That's usually done now with a laparoscope, so it's done with small little incisions.
Well, for our friends at McDonald's, we do not mean to imply in any way that McDonald's French fries lead directly. No,
excuse me, I wasn't being politically correct in that statement. Any brand of French fries.
That's right. Wait. I happen to be a real big fan of In-N-Out French fries. Do they cause gallstones in any fashion?
Well, no, they don't necessarily cause gallstones, but when you have them, that kind of fat intake can elicit the symptoms.
Okay, so what you're saying, it's the saturated fat type of...
Well, a couple of things to say. It probably is true that over the long term, increased fat in the diet does cause gallstones. If you look at Americans and compare them to people in Asia or Africa that have low-fat diets, we have many more gallstones than they do. So probably over time, eating meat and potatoes leads to gallstones in people that have certain genetic predispositions because they tend to run in families.
I would suspect that the dark chocolate could reverse the trend.
Maybe so.
We'll ask Dr. Diane.
The curative powers of dark chocolate.
And the other point is, when you do have gallstones, your gallbladder job is to help you digest fatty foods. So when you eat fatty foods, your stomach recognizes those fats. As when you eat bacon and eggs, your stomach says, here's bacon. It sends out a hormone that signals the gallbladder to squeeze bile into the intestine to help to digest the food. So people that have gallstones and have symptoms, we tell them before surgery, we say, try to avoid fatty foods. Sometimes people can go a long time without developing symptoms by minimizing the fat in their diet.
I'm telling people avoid fatty foods regardless.
Yeah, exactly. So there are people out there that are trying to not have any more attacks by not going to McDonald's, not having pizza, not having fatty food intake.
Well, so those are your bread and butter type surgeries, so to speak.
Yeah.
Or are you commonest? What else do you run into?
Emphasis on the butter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Avoid the butter.
Lots of butter. One of the things I love about practicing in Auburn is I have a fairly broad spectrum of practice. And I'm interested in cancer surgery. I'm the chairman of the cancer committee at the hospital. And I do a fair amount of breast cancer surgery. We do probably at Auburn Faith, we do 70 breast cancer surgeries a year. We see 30 to 50 colon cancer surgeries a year between the four general surgeons in town. We take care of those. And we see other less common cancers. We treat melanoma here. We treat, we'll see unusual small bowel cancer, which is not a common one, but we see once in a while. There's some sort of liver cancer that we usually refer away. Those are cancers that have really need specialty surgical training and some equipment and expertise that we don't have. But by and large, most kind of abdominal and those kind of cancers we treat at the hospital. We treat some lung cancer as well.
And we should mention that our sponsor, Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, where you practice, is a, let me get this right, American College of Surgeons approved cancer hospital.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm saying it wrong.
No, you're doing fine. Let me explain that a little bit. The American College of Surgeons is the largest group of surgeons in the country, and they've been organized since the turn of the century in 1900. Since 1920s, they have a division called the Commission on Cancer, and they have gone about trying to establish and maintain standards at hospitals across the country. So the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer goes to hospitals, and they have a published and well-defined set of criteria and a way they want hospitals run to ensure the highest quality of cancer care and follow-up and data management. And this is something, actually, I'm personally very proud of. Our group of surgeons, when we came to Auburn, the hospital hadn't been accredited. Now, we were doing good work, and the care we were given we thought was top-notch, but we didn't have anybody that was looking over our shoulder confirming that. And so 4 or 5 years ago, Dr. Jenkins and I were sitting in our office, and we decided, why isn't the hospital accredited? We got to fix this. So we found out what we needed to do, and we went to the hospital, and it's a usual bureaucratic administrative stuff, getting committees together, and we set it up, and 3 years ago we were approved, and we're a designated cancer center. Now, they have a number of designations. If you're Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson, or one of the largest cancer centers in the country, they have an academic center, and we're obviously not that. We're a 60 to 80 bed hospital that's in the community, but they have a designation for community cancer centers, and the criteria are a little different than if you're a major metropolitan academic center than they are for a community hospital. But we received a commendation for our work in getting that set up, and that's something we're very proud of.
Okay, we need to take a break now. When we get back, we'll continue our conversation with General Surgeon Bart Bradshaw.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I want to tell you about my dentist, Rodney Kihara. His office is located right in town at High Street and Auburn Folsom Road. His staff is pleasant. They smile when you walk in, and you know who they are because they're there every time. We're talking about Flo, Cheryl, and Judy. Their pleasant faces welcome you into the office and let you know that you're in the right spot, a comfortable place to go to the dentist. Call Dr. Kihara's office at 888-1966. That's 888-1966.
Few things in life are harder than thinking about serious illness or the death of someone you love. Research confirms that Americans want the basic services that hospice provides, care at home or in a home-like setting, treatment that preserves a sense of dignity and respect, emotional and spiritual support for patients and for their families, and effective pain management. Hospice helps patients and their families deal with end-of-life challenges in a life-affirming, compassionate way that brings dignity, hope, and love to every day of life. This message of love and caring is the focus of hospice care. This message is brought to you by Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice. We can be reached at 886-6650 or click on the link for Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice on the Medically Speaking Radio website.
The doctor would say, don't stick anything in your ear. Unless, of course, it's Medically Speaking. On K-High, the voice of the foothills. Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back from the break. This is Medically Speaking Radio on AM 950 K-High, your voice of the foothills. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn and my host, Larry Finney, and we are speaking with Dr. Barton Bradshaw here in Auburn. We were talking a little bit earlier about, in general, what a general surgeon does and what we do here in Auburn and the cancer surgery here in Auburn. Going along the lines of this conversation about cancer surgery, you said that's quite a bit of what you do.
Yes, that's correct.
What cancer would you say is the number one as far as what you spend your time working with and number of procedures?
Well, in Auburn is the same as every other population in the United States and in the world. For women, breast cancer is the most common surgery. For men, prostate cancer is the most common surgery. The second most common is lung cancer, and the third most common is colon cancer. And Auburn reflects that. That's sort of a population-based thing. Those are the kinds of cancers we see. Interestingly, in terms of mortality rates, in other words, which cancer is the most deadly, lung cancer is clearly the most deadly cancer for both men and women. So it's not as common as breast or prostate cancer. We do better at treating prostate and breast cancer. Lung cancer, oftentimes, we don't do as well at treating, oftentimes because it's more aggressive and people present later and it's harder to treat them and cure them.
And of those cancers you're mentioning, I realize lung cancer is the one on that list that doesn't have any specific recommendation for some type of general screening of the public.
That's correct. Unfortunately, chest x-rays haven't been shown to work as well to detect lung cancers early. And a lot of times what happens is people, you know, they're minding their own business, doing their thing, and then they get short of breath and they get fluid around their lung. And sometimes when that happens, surgery is not an option anymore. The only option for treatment is chemotherapy because the cancer is spread out of the primary field where it started.
This is probably a naive attitude on my part, but I would think that screening for lung cancer is a person's lifestyle itself is the screening. Smokers probably are the riskiest bunch, or do you actually bump across folks who have no, you know, the classic lifestyle, whether occupational or smoking issues that you know, they're not coal miners, they're not smokers.
Occasionally you'll see people who are unlucky and they haven't been smokers and they've taken care of themselves and they get a lung cancer. That's unusual. It's very clear that the far and away the vast majority of people that develop lung cancer are smokers. And, you know, it's something we always, you know, people get sick of me nagging them, but they'll come in for something else and I'll talk to them about quitting smoking because I don't want to see them back 10 years later with a lung cancer.
Have you tried steering them to dark chocolate instead?
Or even McDonald's fries.
Well, a little cigarette.
Yeah, if that worked, and as you know, that's something that happens is people have trouble smoking, or when they try to quit, they end up eating a lot and putting on a lot of weight because it's hard to do.
It is. Now, in your group, do you guys have little specialties to yourselves? Because I know there's four of you. Correct?
There's four of us.
Does one do most of the breast cancer, one do most of the colon cancer, or...?
Not necessarily. I think that we are all trained and we all like to treat breast cancer and colon cancer. I probably do most of the lung cancer surgery. The other surgeons in town don't do as much lung cancer surgery. We try to divide them up. I think that I maybe do a little bit more than others. I have an interest in it. Although all my partners are very qualified and they're good surgeons, and we all take care of breast cancer and colon cancer.
The breast cancer, colon cancer, you mentioned prostate, but as general surgeons, you don't do most of that's done by urology.
That's done by urology and radiation oncology. Okay. So. Dr. Lindstad, who's the radiation oncology that works at the Radiation Oncology Center of Auburn, he and Dr. Kirby do most of the prostate cancer work in town.
In the age in which we currently live, what's the prognosis nowadays for prostate cancer and breast cancer patients who've had to undergo surgery?
Well, I can speak to breast cancer better than I can to prostate cancer. Since I don't treat prostate cancer, I don't have those numbers on the tips of my finger. But in terms of breast cancer, we're actually pretty good at taking care of women with breast cancer, and the treatments now are quite effective. Clearly, the prognosis, which is the likelihood that a cancer is going to kill you, or it's going to cause you trouble, or it's going to come back, is related to the stage at which it's diagnosed. And that's why when you hear about cancer treatment, you hear about early detection and treatment. That's why we want people to do breast self-exams. That's why we want them to see their doctors and have a breast exam yearly. That's why we want them to get mammograms. The earlier you can catch a cancer, the better you are at effectively treating it. In stage one cancers, which are, by definition, they're less than 2 centimeters, which is about an inch. They're a little bit less than an inch without spread to lymph nodes. Those women have a 90%+ chance of surviving 5 years. And we use 5 years as it's not a magic cutoff, but the data suggests that if you're going to get a recurrence, so if you've been diagnosed with cancer and it comes back, so they've done studies on this. These are all, of course, retrospective. Your chance of it coming back is much highest in the first 2 years. So if you make 2 years, you got about 75% of cancers come back within two. If they're going to come back, they come back within 2 years. If you make it 5 years, 95% of cancers, 90 to 95, come back within 5 years. So if you make it 5 years, the likelihood that you're going to get cancer and it's going to come back is pretty low. Now, everybody knows somebody that was 7 years after breast cancer and it came back, or 10 years. But those women are actually rare. So we use 5 years just because by then, if they're going to come back, most of them have come back. I don't like to talk about, you know, pat people on the back and say, oh, it's 5 years, you're cured. You know, go have a party. There's no chance it's going to cause you trouble. But in general, we speak about 5 year survival rates because most of those people are going to not only survive 5 years, they're going to survive the rest of their lives and die something else.
I'm glad you clarified that. When you talk about a 5 year survival rate, the thing that jumps into my head is, oh, they've only got five more. You've only bought them five more years. No, that's not it.
Well, yeah, it's as I said, we talk about 5 year survivors because after that, it's pretty unusual for people to have a recurrence and die of their cancer.
So that's the point at which you can begin to breathe a little easier.
You breathe a little easier. So two years, you have a little celebration. 5 years, you have a little more. You know, when you're 25 years down the line, the likelihood that their cancer is going to come back is awfully low.
You know, you talk about early detection and screening, and that kind of flies in the face of recent recommendations from the, American Cancer Society?
No, American Cancer Society is the one that kept the recommendations where they were. The change was by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force under the NIH.
Task Force.
Switching from annual mammograms to biannual and from starting at age 40 to starting at age 50.
This is a fairly controversial year. My sense is I agree with American Cancer Society. I like the recommendations the way they are. But let me just say, it's very clear that we've chosen a cutoff now at 40 that is going to not do mammograms on some women that might have their cancers detected earlier. So some group beforehand decided, well, 40 is the magic number, and 40 is when we're going to start doing annual mammograms. There's some women that are 39 that may have a cancer detected. It's just that statistically, those women are quite unusual. And I think the argument was sort of about, you know, it was an argument based on limited supplies and trying to, and the effectiveness of mammograms. I don't think they were
over-screening.
Yeah, and, you know, those arguments are sort of complicated and probably out of the scope of our discussion. I think that those things are worth thinking about, and that's what task force are for, is think about them. I don't know that most physicians, though, have changed their views about this. The American College of Surgeons has supported the previous recommendations, mammograms at 50, or excuse me, at 40 and yearly.
Yeah, and this is mostly an observation, not requiring a response, but I think one of the side fears of the new recommendations is that they might be used by insurance companies to not pay for screenings before the age of 50 or more frequently than once every 2 years. So
we'll see. I'll be surprised. Again, I think it's a controversial enough and people are very passionate about this. I'd be very surprised if, even if insurance companies threatened to not pay, that they would be able to get away with it. I think that people feel strongly enough about that. And it turns out, breast cancer, I think, is one of those illnesses that, because people feel very strongly about it and that it's so common, I don't usually have insurance companies give me bad time about recommending treatment for breast cancer.
And they have their own lobby, too. I mean, seriously, it's become sort of a political thing. Well, yeah, in fact, talking about pink, my wife and I got a package in the mail just yesterday. She said she had forgotten that this was some kind of a freebie premium or something for, I can't remember, was making a donation or whatever. But it's, believe it or not, pink cookware. It's got the black Teflon on the inside. It's like a saucepan. And it's pink on the outside. It doesn't go with anything we have. But a pink egg timer and a spatula. And I'm thinking, what are you? This is a great white elephant gift. I don't know what you can do with that. There you go.
I know what you're bringing to the K-High Christmas gift exchange.
Yes, indeed. I know Barry's going to be fighting for that one.
I was thinking of Mary Jane. But
yeah, I agree. I think there are some interesting politics. I don't know the details about those. But a couple of years ago, a surgeon from Sacramento, whose name's Ernie Bodai, he was the main driving force behind the breast cancer stamp. And it was sort of his own brainchild, and he just pushed it through. And he came to Auburn, gave a lecture, and told the story. It was fascinating about the sort of political process about how he went about getting this breast cancer stamp approved. Stamp collectors were all opposed to it.
What was their reason for being against
I have no idea. But interesting, some of the other groups, some of the other breast cancer, the pink groups, were opposed to this surgeon advocating for a stamp. And that sort of, I think that has nothing to do with medicine, but is politics. And, you know, Dianne Feinstein sort of took up his cause, and in partnership with her, he got it through. I think it's been a great thing. They've raised a lot of money for breast cancer research.
I would not have imagined that. We don't have quite the same issues going on with lung cancer. Lung cancer, how many cases did you say you do?
Well,
approximately.
Unfortunately, at the hospital, we see much more lung cancer that's inoperable than we actually operate on. And we probably do 10 cases a year of pulmonary resections. But we probably see 40 to 50 cases of lung individuals with lung cancer, many of whom are not candidates for surgery. And one of the interesting things about Auburn, too, is that in general, the population in Auburn and surrounding community is a little bit older. And we reviewed this as part of our cancer committee. We were talking earlier about the things we have done to become accredited by the American College of Surgeons, but we reviewed our experience with a year or two of patients with lung cancer. We found a number of patients that were, by stage, were candidates for surgery, but they were 85 or just made the decision, I don't want to have an operation. I don't want to have my chest cut open and have part of my lung taken out. I don't know that I'll make it. Or for medical reasons or personal reasons, they decided not to do surgery, and they were treated either with comfort care or just didn't do anything. They waited until they died of their lung cancer and decided not to treat it. And that's, depending on your position in life, that's a very reasonable thing for some people. So, you know, in a different community, perhaps, that has people diagnosed at younger age, we might see more surgical candidates, but that was the story for Auburn.
Are there any particular industries in our area that now, 20, 30, 40 years later, you're seeing lung cancer related to that particular work environment?
I don't know that there's any industrial exposures that we see, that I've seen in Auburn. We see a handful of mesothelioma patients. I've probably seen, 20 in the 13 years I've been here.
Mesothelioma?
Mesothelioma is a different kind of cancer that affects the lining of the lung, not the lung itself. So the tissue that surrounds the lung is called pleura, and there's part of it that's on the outside of the chest wall, in other words, inside the chest but not part of the lung, and a little thin layer of this pleura that surrounds each lung. Mesothelioma is the, people have probably seen the ads for mesothelioma for the attorneys. It's related to, almost all that we see is related to asbestos exposure. And the patients that I've seen in Auburn that have developed it worked in Connecticut in the shipyards, or they've had some sort of industrial exposure. It's a bad disease to get. And unfortunately, they've tried some surgical treatments to treat it, but there's an operation called an extrapleural pneumonectomy, which is surgical removal of the entire lung and all the lining around it. And it's a terrible, horrible, big operation. And the mortality rate associated with the surgery is very high. And most places don't do it anymore. There's a few specialty places that still do that operation, but it's a big surgery. It's one of the cases where the cure is worse than the disease almost. Unfortunately, though, nothing else works. Chemotherapy is ineffective. Mostly what we do in those patients...
surgical Hail Mary pass.
Exactly. And if you're willing and wanting to do that, then we'll do it. But again, most of the people that develop it are older, and they just won't tolerate it. One of the things that happens, though, is the cancer cells get in this lining around the lung, and people get a pleural effusion, which means that they get fluid around the lung inside the chest cavity. And the more fluid builds up, it's that fluid actually squashes the lung, and people are unable to breathe when that fluid develops. And so we do an operation called a pleuridesis, which is what we call a palliative procedure. It doesn't help them live any longer, but it tries to prevent that fluid from building up. And there's a couple of ways to do it. What we do usually is we put a little telescope in between the ribs when the patient is asleep and suck out all the fluid. And sometimes you can see a quarter or two of fluid in there. You just take out all this fluid, and then there's this, you know, again, there's normally a space. You can inject, turns out, talk, just sterile talc that,
like
baby powder, like Johnson's baby powder, except some medical company makes it and sterilizes it and charges many more dollars for it. But it turns out it's a little bit, they make it in a spray aerosolizer. So you put this little spray tube into the chest cavity and it looks like a snowstorm with your telescope because this talc's going everywhere. And that talc, it actually serves as an irritant to the lining of the lung. And it makes the lung sticky so that when the lung expands, it fills the chest cavity, and you basically glue the lung with this talc to the chest wall so that there's no place for the fluid to accumulate anymore. And what happens with that is people stay in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, and when they go home, they have no place for the effusion to come up. Now, again, that doesn't make them live longer, but while they're alive, they can breathe because otherwise, this fluid reaccumulates. They're in the hospital every week, having needles put in this fluid and drained out, and it gets to be a kind of an ordeal. So that's the kind of operation we do occasionally on people with. Sometimes that happens in lung cancer as well. Mesothelioma, we do that quite a bit.
Okay. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I wanted to let you know a little bit about our practice at the Auburn Medical Group. The physician, nurses, and front desk personnel all approach the patient, asking themselves the question, how would I want to be treated if I was in the patient's shoes? Listen to what one of our patients has to say about her experience at the Auburn Medical Group.
My name is Susie Brown. I just want to sincerely thank that group of people for being there for me in some emergency situations. They are very efficient, their staff, including their receptionist. Even when you call her, she's got sympathy and compassion for you. And when you're ill, that's what you need. The nurses, the nurse staff is wonderful, and Dr. Vaughn listens to everything you say, and they just get on things. They do not let anything lag.
If you need a doctor, call us at 886-8630 or look at our website at auburnmedicalgroup.com.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back from the break. This is Medically Speaking Radio with your host, Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney. We're speaking with Dr. Bradshaw about cancer surgery. And we've spoken about lung cancer. We've spoken about treatment of breast cancer. The other big cancer that you are involved in is colon cancer.
That's correct.
What's the biggest thing that you think of when you think of treating colon cancer?
Well, there's a couple of issues about this. We've spoken earlier with other cancers about early diagnosis and treatment. And the mainstay of early diagnosis for colon cancer is colonoscopy. Now, that's not done by surgeons. Some of the, it turns out two of my partners do colonoscopies. I don't. I didn't do many in my training. It's not necessary. Some training programs have more colonoscopy than others. The people that do colonoscopies all day long are the gastroenterologists. And there's, right now we have a couple of gastroenterologists in Auburn, and they do screening for colon cancer. So colonoscopies, to diagnose those cancers early, is a really important part of medical care. Once you're diagnosed with a colon cancer, the mainstay of treatment is surgery. So we do operations to take the colon and part of the colon that includes the cancer in and out. We try to take some lymph nodes, we put the colon back together. Occasionally people with colon cancer get chemotherapy as well, depending on whether the tumor has spread to other parts of their body, spread to lymph nodes or not.
And just to review the screening, for people with no family history of colon cancer and no symptoms, we actually recommend that all of them at age 50 go and get checked somehow. There's three major ways that can be done. You sound like you're like me, that you recommend the colonoscopy.
I think the colonoscopy is the most effective. Now, it's also the most expensive. And so we were speaking earlier about breast cancer screening and costs. And if you look at this on a national, sort of international level, which I don't do. That's not my job. But somebody decides, well, colonoscopy is too expensive, we can't do it. They'll recommend a less invasive procedure, a sigmoidoscopy, and you know, occult blood screening tests for the stool. I don't have real strong feelings about that, except that I'm going to get a colonoscopy when I turn 50.
Speaking as one who has done that, that both turned 50 and had the colonoscopy, for any listeners out there who have apprehensions about the screening process, I can tell you it's really no big deal. Don't let that frighten you away from a very important screening. It truly is no big whoopee. So, you know, don't let your imagination run away with you.
Yeah, I think
that's right.
And I think part of my liking of the colonoscopy for screening comes from many people's experience of sigmoidoscopy. Because a sigmoidoscopy, oftentimes, you are not put out like you are for a colonoscopy. And people will be really turned off to the idea of it if they had a sigmoidoscopy, they weren't adequately given sedation or analgesia.
Hold out for the full Monty, because that was probably the most fun part, was just being knocked out. Totally. It really was.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. I really did.
Did you wake up with the taste of dark chocolate in your mouth?
No, but I went home, and because I had to fast for so long, and nothing would stay in for various other reasons, but I went straight for the dark chocolate. You bet. You
know? Were you awake enough to see your colon, the inside of your colon on the screen?
I have no memory of it. They call it conscious sedation, but I don't know where the conscious part comes in.
Yeah,
I don't recall any of it.
Yeah.
There's one story I heard actually from right here at Auburn Faith. I'll go ahead and tell. I don't usually tell stories that are local.
Well, by the way, I did have mine done here at Auburn Faith.
Okay. But apparently it was a lady. She's there behind the curtain, and the person's talking to her about, okay, Mrs. Jones or whatever name, it's time to go home. And she got mad. She got mad because she went through that whole prep, and now they're just sending her home? The sedation was so good. She went from before to after with no in between at all. She didn't even realize it had happened.
Yeah, that was kind of my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, it's a slice of time that doesn't exist for me.
Well, I had a similar experience. I had my shoulder operated on at Sutter Robert Faith a couple years ago, and the anesthesiologist gave me some sedative in the preoperative area. And I have a, half an hour of total blank. I was making jokes. My friends in the operating room have told me what I had said. And I was witty and funny, and I don't remember a word of it.
Kind of sounds like the 60s. As they say, if you can remember the 60s, you didn't experience it. Usually we like to carve out a little bit of time on our shows for war stories, and I didn't prep you for this, Doctor, but... do you have any interesting anecdotal war stories or unusual surgeries or anything that you've had to do in your tenure here?
And since your time is all over the country, you can get away with saying anything.
Oh, yeah, you can make it a fictitious place if you want. If you want to just, protect the innocent.
War stories. Let me take a minute to think about a good one.
Deliver any babies in back of taxi cabs, or remove unusual foreign objects from people, or you have to do emergency.
I had an interesting experience in St. Louis in medical school, in an underserved poor area in St. Louis, and St. Louis is an interesting place. Some of society's sort of socioeconomic problems are a little bit more obvious than they are the other places. I lived in Boston. I've been to San Francisco a lot. The same problems exist there, but in St. Louis, they were sort of all around you more. And I, as a third-year medical student, most of the time we rotated through Barnes Hospital, which is 1,200 beds. It's gigantic. I mean, it's this enormous place, and you can see it from miles away on the freeway. It looks like the Death Star. As you get closer, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And Barnes Hospital is a private institution, and sometimes as a medical student, you were primarily an observer. You watched. Sometimes they would introduce you. Sometimes you just stood at the back of the room and watched the illustrious, famous attendings do their business. And for that reason, sometimes – as a student, we liked to go to the St. Louis Regional Hospital, which was oftentimes run by the medical students and the residents because just there weren't, we were the people there and there wasn't any other people. And that, again, I don't necessarily think that's the best way to do it, but that's how it was. And, you know, my experience in obstetrics was I delivered myself probably 20, 25 children. It was a great experience. And they were from, you know, socially underserved, poor areas. Sometimes there were children delivering babies. There were, you know, 13-year-olds. And this was a child who was asking for her mommy when she was becoming a mommy. And it was, you know, I found those are the kind of problems certainly as a medical student, you felt powerless to fix the problem. The best you could do was treat each person with respect and try to show them the kind of respect and dignity as a human being that they deserved. At the same time, you'd try to help them afterwards. Okay, now you're going to try to take good care of this baby and be a good mother and try not to get pregnant again. And you kind of have those kind of talks. And that was a really interesting and a valuable experience for me. Sometimes there's problems in the world that you can fix and sometimes you can't, but you can always control how you act and how you treat people. And I've remembered that in many other areas of my life.
It's interesting you mentioned regional. I also did a medical student rotation through regional.
Yeah.
It closed in the late 90s there. St. Louis also, you mentioned it. This has nothing to do with surgery, but John Cochran, VA.
Yeah.
The VA way up in the north part of the city.
There. I rotated through there too.
There's something about if you go north of Lyndall in the city of St. Louis, and it was just north of it.
Yeah.
That it's a different part of the city, we'll say. I actually saw a case of tertiary syphilis in that hospital, and I was told, you will never see this again. And it's true. Up to this point, I haven't, but you see things like that in St. Louis.
I'm reminded of another great story. I took my children and my wife. We went to London. We were lucky enough to go to London last summer. And it turns out in London, there's a museum that was formed by a surgeon named John Hunter. And John Hunter was a 18th century surgeon. This is, you know, 100 years before anesthesia. I read a book about him.
Before they even thought of leeches, right?
Yeah. Well, no, he used leeches. And he was actually, a lot of what he did was bleeding. But at the time in medicine in general, anatomy was becoming sort of the rage. And medicine was going from a time when there was this Roman Galenic idea about humors and sort of these sort of ethereal nature of disease. And then they really started looking at organs on people and say, people that died of a problem, they'd look at their liver and say, well, their liver looks wrong. It must be the liver that's caused the trouble. So he did a lot of dissection, but he was this meticulous dissector and anatomist. And he kept all his specimens in jars. And he had this idea that he was going to bequeath this to the British government. And this was going to be his legacy. And in fact, the government took over his collection. Unfortunately, during the Second World War, during the bombings of London, about 2/3 of these were destroyed. But he's got a museum in London, and I took my kids there, and they were sort of fascinated. And there's these old lead jars, and they have an aorta for somebody that had tertiary syphilis. And he dissected the aorta out, and this aorta, which is a big blood vessel that comes out of your heart, it's 5 times normal. In this person, when he was alive, this thing was, you could have seen his aorta beating underneath his skin because it had eroded through his chest wall. And there's hundreds of these specimens, and my kids were, of course, grossed out, but they were fascinated by it at the same time. It was a great time. If anybody goes to London, go look to the John Hunter Museum.
That'd be a good place for a first date.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be a good thing to use here to wrap up the show with. I'd like to see that. We do remind our listeners, you can learn more about our show by going to medicallyspeakingradio.com, our website on the interweb. You can also become a fan on Facebook. You can listen to past episodes just simply by going to either the website or to iTunes. And you can even look at some of our
videos of shows that we've done in the studio live. As always, this is Dr. Mark Vaughn, Larry Finney, and this week, Dr. Bradshaw saying, stay in good health.